Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider, featuring book reviews authored by critics from the New York Times. The Fact Checker by Austin Kelly. The book cover has a man standing at a farmer's market with a cityscape in the background. He is fending off a tomato that is flying towards him. The reviewer is Alexandra Jacobs. He can get the details right, except in his own messy life. Austin Kelly gently lampoons high-minded magazines and the fragile men who work at them in his debut novel, The Fact Checker. There is a picture of a man sitting at his desk with his head in his hands. There is an office phone and a Starbucks coffee and some papers in front of him. Hollywood aspirants had the William Morris mailroom. Junior literati long vied to join the New Yorker's fact-checking department, or for the gals, the typing pool. They hoped to breathe the magic vapors of E.B. White while cooking up the great American novel. In the age of truthiness and fake news, and with ChatGPT hovering like a mockingbird, the role of fact-checker has been newly narrowed and consecrated. Or so suggests The Fact Checker, the first novel by Austin Kelly, a former New Yorker fact-checker. It's a sprightly, hyper-local caper that is also, intentionally or not, a notes and comment on the fragile state of urban intellectual masculinity. We've come a long way from Bright Lights, Big City, which jump-started the career of Jay McInerney, another former New Yorker fact-checker, in 1984. Or have we? Both books have unnamed young male protagonists. Both lampoon entrenched procedures and starchy characters at the New Yorkerish magazines where they toil. In The Fact Checker, which is set in 2004, there's a veteran checker named Mr. Lancaster, a frail old ghost of a man, who stocks the house library with multiple volumes on Civil War artillery and is comically conscripted to check a piece on the rapper 50 Cent. Both narrators bop around downtown and go on benders, though the preferred poison of Kelly's is whiskey, not Bolivian marching powder. Both pine for their exes, then a fashion model named Amanda, now a graduate student, Magdalena. Our 21st century fact checker used to be a graduate student too, specializing in 19th century utopianism, until he realized no one really wanted to read academic history. He worships the Fonz and looks like Tony Shalhoub, the actor. He loves watching baseball and hates playing. There was that painful slow time when the ball arced through the air. It was excruciating. Was I under it? Yes. No. Yes. No. Too late. Since Magda ran off with a professor, he has struggled with romance in New York, where, and this was before the apps, dates and meetings are oft confused, and everyone was tentative and ambiguous. He comes to realize with some consternation, a meat-eater who's never killed anything. One of the things he's compulsive about checking is the fly of his pants. Kelly's hero doesn't long to escape his duties, as McInerney's dissolute alter ego did, but takes pride in his variegated beta role. He's been assigned to check a story about the Union Square Green Market by a debonair but careless restaurant critic named John Manderville, one of whose sources is a farmer, Sylvia. Manderville neglected to get her surname, and so the checker, encouraged by the promise that she's interesting, goes to interview her. Who is Sylvia? Cryptic, lanky, and scarred, she feeds him a life-changing heirloom tomato. She herself is something of a hot tomato. One of the novel's charms is uncovering the vulnerable ornaments, wacky statues, call girls on 11th Avenue, subterranean oyster restaurants, of an increasingly big-box Manhattan. Sylvia and the blank man, as a friend of hers calls him, visit a graveyard in the financial district on an ambiguous date. Then an illegal farm-to-table supper club called Heads and Tails, consuming tongue, offal pie, and pork served five ways. they hook up. And then, lacking a cell phone, as some did then, trying to maintain some freedom, she disappears. Is there something more, something sinister to Mandeville's story? To Mandeville himself? Especially in one chapter, so gruesome I had to read it through reluctantly parted fingers. The fact-checker argues for a heightened sensitivity to the brutality of the food chain. In this, it reminded me of the vegan, Andrew Lipstein's 2023 novel about a financier who starts hearing the animals. But it's also about the looming gig economy, the division of labor in the field of writing as well as potatoes. Not for nothing do we refer to content farms. Planning a story about the Swift Boat smear campaign, the magazine staffers can't quite see yet that they're in a changing ecosystem where supply is soon to outpace demand and alternative facts are hopping onto the conveyor belt of public record. In one Don Draper moment, Kelly's fact-checker considers how strange it is to stand inside a giant building held up so high in the air, with other people standing inside a giant building in other floors, each in their own world, and how hard it is at any minute to know exactly where you are and what caused you to be there and what you should do next. He's researching the collapse of the Twin Towers, which were so boldly featured in the original cover of Bright Lights, Big City. The reviewer, Alexandra Jacobs, reviews all kinds of books, but is often drawn to life writing, which includes biography, memoirs, letters, essays, and some fiction. Lower Than Angels, A History of Sex and Christianity, by Diarmaid McCulloch. The book cover has three cherubian angels, two of them looking down on a pretty, full-figured woman in repose, looking up at them in surprise. The reviewer is Spencer Strub. 2,000 years later, Christians are still worrying about sex. In Lower Than the Angels, the historian, Diarmaid McCulloch, traces two millenniums of libidinal frustration. There is a painting, an 18th century painting depicting the resurrected Christ, asking a clearly disappointed Mary Magdalene not to touch him. Christians today might disagree on any number of questions around gender and sexuality. Can women be members of the clergy? Can same-sex couples marry? Is reproductive choice a right? Is contraception a sin? Does gender transition affirm divine truth, or does it transgress a God-given binary? But as Diarmaid McCulloch explains in Lower Than the Angels, his magisterial new history of the many different Christian attitudes towards sex, these preoccupations define only the past half century of the faith. For the previous 1900 years or so, the most important question was this: is it sinful to get married and have kids? Lower Than the Angels sometimes veers into passages only a specialist could love, but this arcana is well balanced by McCulloch's dry wit and flair for narrative sweep. Recapping the millennium's long debate over the unholiness of wedlock, McCulloch, a distinguished scholar of the English Reformation, an author of award-winning books in church history, and the son of an Anglican clergyman, lines up opposing columns of sex-positive and sex-averse Christian philosophers. Into the prude column goes Jerome, a 4th-century translator of the Bible, and a tireless foe of marital sex. People didn't do it until after the fall, Jerome noted. And scripture aside, as he explains in a letter to a young widow in 394, the babies that often result are gross. Plus, being married is miserable, and remarrying would make her like a dog returning to its vomit. Stick with widowhood, Jerome said, and leave sex to the sinners. Somewhat surprisingly, McCulloch, looking for a pro-sex counter to Jerome, presents the 4th-century bishop Augustine. Though he was troubled by fleshy desire and also down on babies, the feebleness of infant limbs is innocent, but not their minds. Augustine still thought God intended married people to procreate. The bishop of Hippo could also see the counter-argument. Human genitals, after the fall, got a mind of their own, making them basically evil. But their original presence on human bodies in Eden, before the expulsion, meant that God intended people to have sex, and thus married Christians might be forgiven their canoodling, though only as an indulgence. Pious people like Jerome and Augustine could disagree because the Bible says contradictory things. As McCullough points out, the Greek Biblia is plural. The Bible is a library, he muses, not a book. In the Gospels, for instance, Jesus goes to a wedding and condemns divorce, but he also praises eunuchs and forgives an adulterer. In his epistles, Paul grudgingly grants that marrying is better than burning with desire, but virginity is best. Thinkers in the early church, responding to these ambivalent cues and informed by Hellenistic philosophy as well as traditional Greco-Roman misogyny, made avoiding sex a central Christian virtue. Many experiments in holy celibacy followed. The second century saw vogue for voluntary castration, but the fad was brief. On the other hand, the monastic vow of chastity, an innovation of the early church, proved more lasting. Nuns and monks were defined by their discipline, which included overcoming desire. As McCullough notes, one 5th-century monk guarded against temptation by putting a snake in his privates, a more conservative choice than chopping them off altogether. By the Middle Ages, the Western Church expected celibacy of all clerics, not just monks, but enforcement was inevitably patchy and rollout was slow. Then came the Reformation, a revolution brought on by a one-time friar named Martin Luther. The former monk married a former nun and bedded her, in McCullough's words, with a glee of delayed adolescence. It was a feeling that Luther wanted to spread. In 1525, he wrote a letter of apology to a friend whose wedding he was missing. "I assure you that I'll make love to my wife in your honor while you're making love to yours. A joint effort." For Protestants, marital sex was good and priests should marry. Counter-reforming Catholics responded to this sexual upheaval by doubling down on priestly celibacy. The author clearly sympathizes with reformers like Luther and the 17th century Bishop Jeremy Taylor, who described his children as so many little emanations of joy. So it makes sense that Lower Than the Angels understates celibacy's appeal, both spiritual, medieval accounts of tasting Christ's foreskin, or suckling at Christ's breasts attest to remarkable capacity to transfigure bodily urges into devout yearnings, and practical. The danger of childbirth alone was good reason to prefer the cloister to marriage. McCullough is clear on the costs of chastity. A culture of deference and shame has abated centuries of poisonous silence over clerical sexual abuse. Still, priestly marriage is no panacea, as a string of sexual assault scandals in Protestant congregations attests. Compared with the long struggle over marriage, other sexual panics seem like flashes in the pan. McCullough, whose talent for breadth is matched by his impressive command of the details, points out a curious Enlightenment-era masturbation fever that lasts a mere 200 years or so. In 18th-century Britain, groups of Scottish gentlemen form secret societies dedicated to what McCullough delicately refers to as onanistic contemplation of females hired for the spectacle, as a panicked English public rushed out to buy anti-masturbatory tracts like the incautiously titled Seaman's Monitor. At the end of the century, the lifelong bachelor, Immanuel Kant, who was raised as a Lutheran, reasoned that masturbation was worse than suicide. That stance has proved less enduring than his categorical imperative. The convictions of contemporary culture warriors might someday seem similarly fleeting. The Bible makes no explicit mention of abortion, and, as McCullough observes, uncompromising Catholic opposition to it only dates to 1869. And despite what is written in Deuteronomy, Jesus himself says nothing about homosexuality. James I of England, no slouch in the scripture department, defended his special relationship with a courtier, George Villiers, by pointing to the disciple whom Jesus loved. Christ had his John, the king explained, and I have my George. Despite hints of progressive sympathy, McCullough cautions those in search of a queer-friendly world in the ancient Christian past against too much utopian thinking. He gently dispenses with the argument that monastic brother-making rituals were the ancestors of gay marriage, and he thinks that 5th-century stories of transmasculine monks who lived as holy men but whose female body parts were discovered upon their deaths only contained a kernel of truth. When the book arrives at the second half of the 20th century, however, he admits that he must drop any pretense to historical objectivity. His pride in hard-fought Anglican inclusivity, the church's acceptance of clergywomen, for instance, is palpable, as is his dismay over the rise of reactionary gender politics in denominations ranging from fundamentalist Protestantism to Russian Orthodoxy. Lower Than the Angels addresses a global Christianity, increasingly rived by fierce disagreements over sex and gender. McCullough's hope is that a dose of careful history might lower the temperature of those fights. The chronicles of Christian sexuality are full of discord, accommodation, and reinvention. While undeniably punctuated by violence and persecution, the many turns in these religious thoughts and deeds inevitably undermine the cruelest certainties of the present. As McCullough writes, knowledge is like a medicine to soothe a fever. Sadly, though, medicine only works if you're willing to take it. The reviewer, Spencer Strub, lectures on medieval literature at Princeton University. His book, Scorn, Shame, and the Simple Reader, Lay Piety and Literature in Late Medieval England, will be published in 2026. The Gate, the Girl, and the Dragon by Grace Lynn. The reviewer is Aditya Sriram. Grace Lynn's long-awaited new fantasy novel stars her first animal protagonist. A mythical lion cub stuck in the modern world must harness the power of stories to save his family and return home. There is a picture of a rocky shore with a lion cub standing on a rock and facing a giant dragon that is coming out of the waves towards him. Fall into a hole and thump into Wonderland. Open a wardrobe and step into Narnia. Board a train on platform 9 3/4 and end up at Hogwarts. Crossing the thresholds comes naturally to children, which is one of the reasons middle grade fantasy is so popular. The quests are timeless. Cue Grace Lynn, whose latest novel, The Gate, the Girl, and the Dragon, embraces this trope as well. Her setting is a bustling urban center in the middle of which stands the old city gate. Passing through it is uneventful for humans. Aside from entering a neighborhood filled with dangling red lanterns and traditional foods and crafts. But for a group of mythical creatures called Gonshi, it's the only way back to their realm of grasslands, rivers, and mountains. Gonshi are lively and fun-loving, but once they're in the modern world, they manifest as stone, standing silent and still. They hide in plain sight in the form of statues, highway pillars, and necklace pendants. Lifeless to the human eye, they watch over the city's populace and protect them from danger. All Gonshi take their job seriously, except for one. Lin's main character, Jin, is a Gonshi lion cub who would rather play with his friends than play guardian. Early in the book, he becomes angry at his father and accidentally knocks over the sacred sphere, a golden ball that is never to be moved. As it bounces out of the house and through the old city gate, Jin chases after it, trying desperately to catch it. But he fails, and the gate clangs shut behind him. Jin is now stuck on the wrong side. Will the impetuous cub ever see his parents again? For the remaining 300 pages, Jin is on a quest to reopen the gate and return home, an adventure that's both physically and emotionally taxing. Along the way, he meets a girl, a sculptor, and a dragon who takes the shape of a worm, not all of whom he can trust. Meanwhile, the other Gunchi spends several chapters also trying to reopen the gate, in hopes of rescuing Jin and retrieving the sacred sphere. This narrative structure is one of Lin's signatures, parallel plot lines that hurtle forward and finally triumphantly converge. Other elements of her style that recur throughout her fantasy novels are equally energizing. She nests stories within stories, concocts lush place names like the City of Bright Moonlight, creates vibrant full-color illustrations. Perhaps most tantalizing, her titles for these novels often sound like riddles. Where the Mountain Meets the Moon, When the Sea Turned to Silver. To solve them, readers must read on. Book sales and awards prove that they do so with enthusiasm. The Gate, the Girl, and the Dragon, however, struggles with pacing. The sculptor's storyline, while a driver of the novel's main action, distracts from Jin's quest. Throughout the book, in an attempt to merge urban fantasy with pastoral otherness, Lin brings up smartphones, high-rises, subways, the Metropolitan Museum of Art. The effect is jarring. There is only so much activity a gate can handle, even a magical one. What the novel gets right is Jin. A stubborn adolescent, he is different from Lin's previous heroes, all of whom are human and revere the power of stories. Jin only pretends to listen to his father's tales until he exiles himself to a world where his only way out is trusting in their wisdom. The harder Jin's challenges become, the longer the gate stays closed, and the more the young lion matures. There were things more important than a game, more important than what he himself wanted. That was part of being a stone spirit, he admits to himself about two-thirds of the way through the book. Jin is not the only skeptic to have his mind changed. Growing up in upstate New York, Lin rejected her Chinese heritage and resisted learning her mother tongue. But while studying illustration at the Rhode Island School of Design, she traveled to Italy, where, sitting in a cafe and discussing her love of making books, she realized she had completely ignored the rich material her own culture could provide. Gods and goddesses, fish and mermaids, sacred threads and stones, the possibilities were endless. She just had to step into that world and give it a chance. Thresholds are vital in literature and in life. They allow Max to visit the wild things and Dorothy to reach Oz. They enable writers to commute through time and space to author coming-of-age stories for their characters and for themselves. Lin traveled to China and to Taiwan from where her parents emigrated, her gateways across the Pacific, to steep herself in their symbols and mythology. Combining her observations with her fictional instincts, she produced a best-selling oeuvre, oxygenated with Chinese folklore. Each book is an ode to her roots and a genuine celebration of diversity. The Gate, the Girl, and the Dragon, despite its shortcomings, demonstrates Lin's originality yet again, for she has inverted the trope. Her hero is magical instead of human, and her gateway matters, not because Jin goes through it, but because he returns home. The reviewer, Aditya Shriram, teaches writing at the Shiv Nadar School of Law in Chennai, India. She's the author of Beyond the Boulevards, a short biography of Pondicherry. Murder at Gull's Nest by Jess Kidd. The book cover is mustard yellow, with a giant teacup holding a cliff and a house at the edge of it. The teabag handle, hanging over the edge of the cup, has a skull and crossbones. The reviewer is Sarah Weinman. Nora Breen, the plucky practical sleuth in Murder at Gull's Nest, published by Atria, has checked into the Gull's Nest boarding house in an English seaside town in 1954. She's there to find her friend Frida, who has been writing faithfully to her each week until, abruptly, she doesn't. Ominously, Frida's last letter had concluded, "I believe every one of us at Gull's Nest is concealing some kind of secret. I shall make it my business to find out, and so I shall finally have something riveting to write to you, dear friend." Nora arrives at Gull's Nest with some secrets of her own, such as the fact that she spent 30 years as a Carmelite nun, Sister Agnes of Christ. To investigate her friend's disappearance, Nora must leave behind the part of herself that clamored for the solitude of a religious order and live fully in the world, embracing its chaos. It isn't easy, especially when another guest at Gull's Nest turns up dead, poisoned by cyanide. Frida's handkerchief is tucked into one of his pockets. Kids Turn to Cozy Mysteries after several genre-stretching novels is a welcome one that tantalizes the prospect of more installments. As Nora adroitly observes, there's work to be done and deductions to be made. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.